Professor Vlad Perjeau is director of the Clow Center for the Study of Constitutional Democracy here at Boston College and a tenured associate professor at BC Law School. His primary research interests include the law of the European Union, comparative constitutional law and theory, international and comparative law and jurisprudence. He was awarded the 2009 Jus Commune Prize for his article Reason and Authority in the European Court of Justice, and his paper Cosmopolitanism and Constitutional Self-Government was selected for presentation at the 2010 Yale-Stanford Junior Faculty Forum. In 2008, he was appointed by the President of Romania to a 7-member commission on constitutional reform, and he remains actively involved in the process of constitutional reform, both in Romania and across the European Union. He has a doctorate in law from Harvard Law School, law degrees from the University of Bucharest and the University of Paris, and an LLM degree from the European Academy of Legal Theories. So he's been to school for a while. He's been around the world, and we're delighted that he's part here at Boston College and here at the head of our table. So welcome, Vlad.
Thank you so much, Eric, and thank you all. Thank you all for coming. It's wonderful to see you all here. Eric has mentioned that I should be speaking for about 15 to 20 minutes and I should not formally present in a paper. However, used as I am with the academic customs, I do have a paper which I will not be reading, but I will do the way the President of the United States does with the State of the Union. I will ceremonially give it to him the way that that is done with the Speaker of the House.
I accept it on behalf of the Wazi Center.
That is my offering, my offering to you. With my
I will note diversions from the text.
With my gratitude for having invited me. There won't be much about Viktor Orban and the constitutional tragedy of Hungary in the first 15 to 20 minutes, but I hope we can talk about that later. And that might, in fact, even be a bit of a challenge to the kind of framework that I will be presenting here. The title of my talk today is Cosmopolitanism in Constitutional Law. Legal cosmopolitanism has a very bad name in law. Cosmopolitans are thought to be naive, sloppy lawyers, and just disingenuous intellectuals. Naive because they are the ones who emphasize the importance of uniting the world, of a world government, of an international state, at a time when sovereign states remain as powerful and as present and as assertive as they have always been in the history, in the recent history of the world. Even in the European Union, the most exciting experiment in governance in the modern world, we see the importance that states, that state self-interest still has. Sloppy because legal cosmopolitans are the ones who derive legal obligations from moral obligations. While indeed it might be the case that borders, political borders, should have no moral relevance, that we all have duties towards our peers simply by virtue of belonging to the human race. To imply legal duty from moral obligation is something that only a sloppy lawyer would do, and that's, again, an understandable criticism. Think about, if you walk by a pond and somebody is drowning and you are an Olympic athlete, you won Michael Phelps. You're Michael Phelps walking by Walden Pond and you see somebody swimming, drowning. Do you have a legal obligation to go rescue that person? The answer is no. There is no duty at common law to help that person. Now, moreover, you have a very significant disincentive because the second you start helping, you have to behave as a rational person would. So no duty to rescue at common law, even though, of course, you're going to get to the deepest of hell. But lawfully, you can enjoy your time around. Disingenuous because it's so obvious that states have a very significant sticking power, are around to stay. And it's so obvious that the legal obligations should not be derived solely from the existence of moral obligations that anybody who claims otherwise must be onto something else. What's really at stake is something else in the claim to legal cosmopolitanism, and that is, scratch the cosmopolitan claim and underneath you'll find the imperialist, you'll find the colonialist, intuition, impulse, attitude. This is a very common, very general way of thinking about legal cosmopolitanism in law. I will challenge this. And I will challenge it by looking mostly at the Kantian tradition in political and legal thought. Kant adamantly did not talk about the world government. He talked about the plurality of states. His view of obligations was adamantly legal. He wasn't concerned with philanthropy, but with right, as he put it. And much of his work was a reaction to the horrors of European colonialism. Recovering the legacy of that cosmopolitanism and putting it to work is not only an interesting act of intellectual exercise, but it is an extraordinarily important kind of work to do in order to understand the world we live in, what it is, what it can be, what it shouldn't be. Before taking cosmopolitanism to the place where I want to situate it, and that is constitutional law of all places, let me say a word about international law. Because traditionally, the cosmopolitan ideal, to the extent that it has been found to have a home in legal thought, it was in international law. It wasn't anywhere else. And indeed, cosmopolitanism has been very helpful in understanding some of the presence of individuals in international law, as individuals have been moving to the mainstream of international law and occupying the same position as states have. Cosmopolitanism is an essential part of international law, but I will suggest to you that it is not the entire story, that there is more to the work that the cosmopolitan ideal can do in law than is captured in the international sphere. One caveat has to concern European law. There have been recent attempts by scholars, and actually not so recent, to apply the cosmopolitan framework, and especially the Kantian cosmopolitan framework, to what has been happening in the European Union. To say that Europe is an example of cosmopolitanism, and to analyze it along those ways. I don't want to discuss that here. Those attempts are interesting. They might partly be right. But what sets European law apart is the fact that it has an overarching institutional structure of the type that you don't see anywhere else in the world. Eric and I were talking before about what's the difference, before the event, about the difference between international law and global constitutionalism, and one significant difference is the institutional level. There are no overarching institutions in global constitutionalism in a way that there are overarching institutions in international law. So my interest is constitutional law. My interest is specifically cosmopolitanism as an intellectual framework for understanding recent phenomena in constitutional law that have been called by Frank and others globalization of constitutional law. Specifically, I'm interested in the question if it is possible to dispense with methodological nationalism in thinking about constitutional questions. I hope it's possible. I think it should be. And then I'm just looking for a way to do it. So in terms of the structure of my argument, I'm doing quite well here. I will start by describing a little bit the phenomenon, what's been happening in constitutional law over the past two or three decades. Where are we? Why are we even paying attention to this thing? How can we even talk about globalization in constitutional law? How I am somebody who grew up in Romania, studied in Europe, and here I am in the United States teaching constitutional law. 20 years ago, that would have been unfathomable. I mean, probably it should still be unfathomable. But at least the institutional mistake of having hired me to teach constitutional law would not have taken place. So that's number one. Describe the phenomenon, what's happening in globalization and constitutional law. Then say a few words about Kant's project of perpetual peace. First, how it fits the phenomenon of globalization in constitutional law. And most importantly, I see David, I see Jonathan, people who know their Kant, Alan. To try to argue that there is a missing step in Kant's theory of perpetual peace. That the way he thought about it in three major levels, and there is a level that contemporary evolutions in constitutional law show, added to the theory. And in the spirit of Kant, but really a mistake in Kant's overall account. And then finally, if time allows, a little bit a discussion, a few critiques of cosmopolitanism in constitutional law. First of all, the critique from democracy. Isn't constitutional law about self-government? How can you talk about anything that does not immediately address the question of self-government? I call it nicely the critique from democracy should be perhaps called the critique from nationalism, and the critique from history, the colonial legacy of cosmopolitanism, and then finally the critique from politics. And then the Q&A will probably take us in the direction, what has this got to do with American law? Though I will suggest to you that it has to do quite a bit with American law. First, the transformation of the constitutional landscape. We know too much about the debate about the use of foreign law. The way in which the conversation about globalization of constitutional law, the movement of constitutional ideas in contemporary society, has taken shape in the American intellectual and political discourse, has been around the controversy on the use of foreign law. Is it legitimate for judges to refer to the decision of foreign courts in the process of interpreting their own constitution as they need to decide the cases that are before them? There we know the position that this is illegitimate because constitutional law is about the sub-government of a particular polity. We know a little bit of the argument, the critique being made by Justice Scalia. We know the other side of the argument made by people like Justice Breyer, that, if it works in another country, why not use it here, a version of pragmatism. What I want to draw your attention to is not so much where people fall on this question, but really the question of, imagine the background, imagine how much has to be shared, to speak like Habermas, in the constitutional life world of these different systems for the question of the relevance of foreign law, for the debate over the relevance of foreign law to even make any sense. So you need to have questions that are by and large similar or at least understandable. You need to have constitutional provisions that look by and large similar. You need to have an institutional structure that is recognizable. One important set of agents in that institutional structure has to be judges. Judges have to be allowed to exercise in judicial review of legislation. You need to have written constitutions. You need to have an idea of the constitution that is not, that is not a pamphlet, but that is law. The second great American contribution to the world, probably the first one is the hamburger. really, you need to have so much shared by way of commonality of the constitutional mindset. And indeed, if you look at it descriptively, this appears to be the direction in which our world is going. Even North Korea has a written constitution. I mean, it's a very sad story, but you can Google it, look it up, and you will find that it's one of those .com websites. And then you will find there the written constitution of North Korea is relatively long, and then you'll even find the website of the North Korean government. Surreal. But read it if you have the time. So there are written constitutions everywhere. Even the few countries that don't have written constitutions, have codified constitutions, or they have codified significant parts of the constitution. New Zealand is one. Israel, another. This is a development that has started, of course, that started in American law with the idea of a written constitution that then traveled under the enormous German influence. The world has been taking the shape not of the United States as far as constitutionalism is concerned, as much as Germany, over the past in the last half a century or so, and then recent, more or less recent developments, being the fall of communism, the process of constitution making in Eastern Europe, the enormously intriguing, almost revolutionary process of constitution making in South Africa at the end of the apartheid regime, and we still see instances of that now with the constitutional evolutions in places like Myanmar. To be sure, constitutional systems have as many similarities as they have differences. So one important question will be, well, why pay attention to the similarities? Why not look at the differences, since it's possible to look at both? But if you look at similarities, and we can talk about this, the question is, at what level do you get to look? There is an argument that comes from 20th century comparative law, which says that convergence and transplants are more likely to happen with respect to private law. Because in private law, political actors have no understanding of the technicalities of the rules. They don't understand the stakes. They do not step in to claim any kind of argument from self-government. So you will find more stronger transplants, stronger constitutional borrowing, a different dynamic in the circulation of constitutional ideas in private law than you will in public law. Now, if you move to public law, there is an argument that you are likely to find much more convergence with respect to the Bill of Rights provisions. And indeed, if you read the Bill of Rights of lots of constitutional democracies around the world, they will be strikingly similar, which, again, might be a problem, but that's a descriptive reality, then convergence at the level of structure. So where is convergence taking place? It's taking place in the idea of the written text, then in the substance of the written text, in many of the doctrines, doctrines of standing, for example. In over the past few decades in American law, courts have been cutting back on standing doctrines. Fewer and fewer people are allowed to find the day in court. Fewer and fewer people are allowed to come before judges. Just the opposite is happening everywhere around the world. If you talk to, I was asking this question of Aaron Barak, the former president of the Israeli Supreme Court, and a person who teaches all the time in the United States, who's very well familiar with all the different debates. He couldn't understand what the debate about standing was all about. Of course, standing should be completely broad, completely open. Open standing, open access to courts at any level has revolutionized constitutional law in Latin America, from Brazil to Colombia to Bolivia, Argentina, enabling individuals to go before courts to make constitutional claims has really changed the constitutional landscape. So convergence or significant similarities with respect to substantive doctrines, then method. The greatest transplant of the 20th century, in the second half of the 20th century, has been a constitutional method of interpreting rights. Of the advanced constitutional democracy, only the United States is sort of nominally, has not nominally embraced this method, although there are four justices on the Supreme Court right now who believe that that's a fairly fine method. And this is a method of constitutional rights that does not limit rights at the definitional level, but rather, as it happens in American law, but rather limits the right at the level of application. So you may still have a right to privacy, but there might be contrary interests that the community or the state can put forth. And the application of your right in a particular context is blocked by those conflicting interests, but that doesn't mean you don't have a right, which is almost incomprehensible to the American constitutional mind. If you have the right, it must mean something. If it doesn't mean anything in reality, it means you don't have the right. A very different conception of constitutional method has been spreading around the world. It started in 19th century Prussian administrative law. It has made its way to mid-20th century German constitutional law, and then from there pretty much everywhere around the world. So methodological convergence, then issues of institutional structure, principle of separation of powers, then some convergence at the ideological level. Much of the scholarship looking at this transformation of the constitutional landscape asks the question, why has it happened? Why do we see this movement of constitutional ideas? And there have been a number of causal accounts that have been put forth. Some place law at the center of the as one of the main causes of development. Others believe that law is, in a rather Marxist way, just an epiphenomenon. If you really want to understand why things are happening, you have to look beyond. You have to look at the behavior of economic agents. So a very powerful theory says that you see all these developments in constitutional law because basically capital is free to move. And so all these countries, by democratizing themselves, are trying to attract capital. So this is sort of one of the bottom-up accounts of causal accounts. And then there are a number of others. Reputation is important. States matter about reputation. Learning, kind of Breyer-like, we need to learn from other countries. Nobody's paying attention to the question of what. Okay, what is happening? What exactly is this transformation about? Why if indeed we see some convergence, what is the best account of the convergence that we see? Now, this is exactly the kind of jurisprudential project that lawyers are trained to come up with. What is the best account, and by the best account, we mean what is the account that fits and justifies the practice the best? I want to suggest that there is something in Kant's conception of cosmopolitanism that might be helpful to what we're doing here. Am I going to... How much time do I
You're
still
okay.
have?
15 minutes, 10 minutes.
Wonderful. Kant thinks of... Kant is concerned with peace. Kant is concerned with perpetual peace, as I mentioned. And he... proposes three definitive articles. The first one is that all nations should have republican constitutions. It's a very counterintuitive thing. I'll return to it in a second. The first definitive article, if you want perpetual peace, all nations should have republican constitutions. Then nations become part of this voluntary federation of nations. And then thirdly, the principle of hospitality as the principle that regulates cross-border interactions. I want to suggest that there is a missing step in Kant. That once, and this is exactly the step that we see in the globalization of constitutional law, that the second nations develop republican constitutions, which is pretty much what we now call they become constitutional democracies, they start a process of interacting with one another that is jurisgenerative, that leads to the creation of new norms, that changes the conceptual mindset of the significant legal actors, that sets in place a dynamic of constitutional ideas that ought to be explained, that is extremely important. And that's not something that you find in Kant. Let me first, very briefly, argue that what Kant means by the first definitive article, that all nations should have republican constitutions, is by and large a version of what we know to be constitutional democracy. Now, he didn't call it that way. He had a major problem with democracy because he thought that was, you know, unrepresented will running things, and representation is a very important matter. What characterized the republican constitution? Well, it's the idea of freedom, is the idea of equality, by which he meant formal equality, is perfectly consistent with the greatest material inequality, and then the idea of self-government. This is an idea that has pretty much traveled all the way to us and has revolutionized, changed the way we think about politics. The idea that you're free only to the extent that you are the subject of constraints that you impose on yourself. It's a very important lesson that perpetual peace, the peace of among nations, would come down to domestic justice, would come down to the domestic structure of the different states. There is a relation, there is an account of why that might be so. He doesn't emphasize the fact that the citizens of democracies are morally enlightened, though he did think that they were more enlightened than the citizens of other forms of government. And this is an argument that comes to us all the way from Aristotle. We know that citizens, that the shape of the soul depends on the type of political regime under which you happen to live. That the subjects of oligarchies are different from the subject of tyrannies, are different from the subject of democracies. And in what sense they're different? Well, in a Kantian account, they're better, and that's the right account. But it's not moral enlightenment that explains the connection between domestic structure, domestic institutional, constitutional structure and peace, but rather Kant says, well, it's self-interest. If people are consulted, as they typically are in situations like going to war, then it will be against their self-interest to actually vote. Now, there's acquiesce in that decision. There's much to be talked about here. Not much of it is very complementary to Kant. We know that things are much more nuanced. We know that indeed democracies do have some sort of a propensity, have less of a propensity to go to war with other democracies, but they are very willing to do it with non-democracies. Just, you know, think in recent memory, you know, open the newspaper. But for my purpose, the essential connection is the connection between the emphasis on the Republican Constitution, the emphasis on the domestic constitutional structure, and the higher levels, the securing of the conditions that make freedom possible through the accomplishment of peace. Kant, unlike Hobbes, understood that unless you manage to rule out war as a possibility at the supranational level, it will not be sufficient to establish peace domestically. And of course, peace is enormously important as a condition for self-realization, as a condition for freedom. This is very much what... So you can look at contemporary constitutional democracies in the spirit of rationalizing what's going on, and you can see this development of the different constitutional democracies getting republican constitutions, so to speak. The second part of the argument, which I will not talk about it for way too long, this is the this is something that has puzzled very many Kant commentators. Why is he talking about... Why has he not embraced a world republic or an international state? Why has Kant embraced a non-coercive federation of states? Now, he's changed his mind about it. He embraces the non-coercive federation of states at the time when he writes Perpetual Peace. He thought differently before. So not only is it a federation of states, but it is a voluntary federation of states. Much of this has to do with Kant's conception of the state, with Kant's conception of what is... what can be imposed on people, what extent imposing things actually conditions the exercise of self-government, and also with the idea of perhaps this is only a step in the creation of a world republic or an international state. The issue is highly debatable. In any event, this is the international structure. And then there is a third part of it, which is hospitality. Again, I won't talk too much about it. And hospitality basically has to do with, broadly understood, there's an argument that it should be understood more narrowly, it has to do with all human claims that are cross-border in scope. Of course, if you don't do away with the plurality of states, if you don't do away with jurisdictions, with borders, you're going to end up having to have a principle about what happens when people cross them. And the hospitality is the principle here. There is nothing in Kant about exactly what we see happening in constitutional law. But it's not difficult to integrate or to apply this conception, the Kantian conception of perpetual peace, to the phenomenon of the globalization of constitutional law. This takes a lot. You have to have an account of not only the separation of powers, which is something that's very important to him. So you have to develop the theory in a Kantian direction, but leave Kant behind. So there is the principle of separation of powers, there is the idea of self-government, but then you can actually go and illuminate, I will claim, in a way that maybe we can discuss in the questions and answers, illuminate many of the contemporary developments that we see in constitutional law from the development of the doctrine of standing. Why has standing been liberalized? I think it has to do with the conception of responsiveness that is very much related to what Republican Constitution requires, to the use of foreign law. Why do the experiences in self-government of other communities of free and equal, other free community of equals should be relevant to the self-government of another community? I believe there is an answer there, and the answer goes through the a Kantian approach, so on and so forth. There is a way to think about the rule of law. There is a way to think about the what of the globalization of constitutional law that draws very much on this kind of a framework. I will end, because I've been talking for way too long, I will end very briefly by saying that there are a number of ways of looking critically at this argument. The first one is the critique from democracy. Jack Goldsmith has made the argument that cosmopolitan action is bounded by constituency preferences. So that, for example, the United States, I mean, he's not interested in the constitutional level, but at the supranational level, he's interested in the United States ratifying global treaties and engaging in supranational, in humanitarian action that would lower, I quote unquote, lower net U.S. welfare. Now, I in the paper that Eric has, I made the argument that this is not this is a statistical conception of democracy. It's not Kant's conception of democracy. It's not Kant's conception of what a republican constitution entails. And the point is to put power to the discipline of reason rather than to allow power to run wild. Then there is the argument about history and the argument from politics. But I will stop here. There hasn't been much about Viktor Orban, but please ask me a question about Orban. Please ask me about Viktor Orban.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.